So very broadly, what I want to do is to tell you a little bit about today in which ways in which supersymmetric grand unified models of particle physics can be obtained from F-theory compactified on an elliptically fibered collabial fourfold. This talk is based on joint work with Jonathan Heckman and Kerman Vaffa at Harvard. It appears here on the archive. And let me also mention that just more or less concurrently with this paper, there's a very closely related paper on the same subject by Rhonda Nagy and Martin Weinholt. Which I also want to mention. So, of course, the talk today is really about F-theory, but before I get going into F-theory, I want to begin by just recalling some very general ideas for ways to obtain n equals 1 supersymmetric guts in string theory. So to organize the discussion, let me draw the usual string duality web. So for example, we have M-theory at the top, and it's, say, incarnations 11-dimensional supergravity. We have the type 2 theories. We have type 1, and we have the two heterotic theories. Now, I think it's safe to say that there have been attempts at string model building in all these corners of the duality web, and in each corner, there are various advantages and disadvantages to each approach. So, for instance, the most venerable way to obtain a gut model from string theory is to consider the E8 cross E8 heterotic string compactified to four dimensions on a collabial threefold, and then at least in principle, if we choose if we embed an instanton in the gauge bundle on the collabial threefold, then it's possible to break one of these E8 factors down to one of the standard gut groups, say G is equal to SU5, SO10, or E6. And similarly, it's in principle easy to obtain massless charged chiral matter, which transforms in one of the standard gut representations that contains one generation of the standard model. So say the 10 plus the 5 bar, the 16, or the 27. So that's very natural in principle. Of course, in practice, obtaining the right collabial and the right bundle so as to find what's to satisfy anomaly cancellation and to find even semi-realistic phenomenology is really quite a technically challenging problem in algebraic geometry. So that's sort of a disadvantage to this approach. Now, sort of more recently, there's been a lot of attention paid to model building based on type 2 or interfold compactifications. So type 2a or 2b in the presence of d-branes and fluxes. So in this approach, both the non-abelian gauge symmetry of the gut and the charged chiral matter come from the world volume theory living on the branes in the compactification. And so I think it's safe to say at this point that we have a fair amount of intuition for those world volume theories, perhaps even more so than in the heterotic string. On the other hand, the sorts of gauge theories that one finds on d-branes in these weakly coupled collabial range-fold backgrounds are rather particular. So for example, you know that on typically you find on the world volume of the d-branes some quiver gauge theory, which the gauge group G is just a product of some SUN factors with massless charged chiral matter transforming in the direct sum of bifundamental representations under those factors. So this is so. And this weakly coupled type 2 approach, you're never, for instance, going to find an exceptional gauge group like E6 or exceptional, what you might consider exceptional matter like the 16 of SO10. So, of course, one can also in this quiver approach find gauge groups besides SUN gauge groups, SO gauge groups, SO or SP if one allows, of course, orientifolds in the game. The simplest way to put in an orientifold is just to consider type 2B in the presence of D9 branes. So that takes us to model building, effectively model building in type 1. And type 1 is also directly related under S-duality to the SO32 heterotic string. So model building issues in this corner of the web are quite similar. So let me also say a little bit of word about M-theory. The natural arena for model building in M-theory is to consider M-theory compactified to four dimensions on a 7-manifold of G2 holonomy. So in this case, model building is very geometric because both the non-abelian gauge symmetries and the charged chiral matter will come from allowing various sorts of singularities in this G2 manifold. So that's kind of a nice feature. On the other hand, once we start discussing G2 manifolds, we've left the realm of algebraic geometry, where we were effectively living for the heterotic string or the type 2 theories. And so in practice, it can be very difficult to get one's hands on explicit examples of compact G2 manifolds that you would want to describe semi-realistic gut sorts of models. So that's kind of a little bit of a disadvantage there. So I've left out F theory on this diagram. I'm going to draw F theory in a somewhat privileged position in the middle of the web. I do so for two reasons. First of all, F theory is really should be thought of as a strong coupling limit of the type 2B string, because of course in F theory we allow the type 2B string coupling constant to vary and even to undergo duality transformations as we move around in the compactification manifold. And so the string coupling in particular is typically of order 1 on the compactification manifold. And also, F theory provides the natural language in which to express the duality between type 2B and the heterotic string. And this is actually very intriguing from the perspective of model building for the following reason. So as you'll see, embedding gut models in F theory, on the one hand, it can be expressed very naturally in the sort of brain language that you would use, say, in type 2 model building. The non-abelian gauge symmetries in the chiral matter will come from brains in F theory. But on the other hand, F theory, you have much more flexibility in F theory, essentially because it's built of the heterotic string. And so it's quite natural in F theory to obtain both exceptional gauge groups and exceptional matter that you just really can't find when you're working at weak string coupling in the type 2 setup. So that was just a very schematic introduction. What I want to do now is say just a little bit more about F theory itself. So I have a little interlude on F theory in a nutshell. So I'm going to discuss F theory in the context for which I'll be considering it, namely F theory compactified to four dimensions, preserving n equal to 1 supersymmetry on X, a Clavial fourfold, which I assume to be elliptically fibered with a section over a complex threefold B with elliptic fiber, bold face E sub tau. So E sub tau is, of course, just a two torus, which carries a complex structure parameterized by tau. Now, the physical role of tau, physically in type 2B, tau is just interpreted as the usual axial dilaton, C0 plus I e to the minus phi. And so, in particular, tau is allowed to vary holomorphically over the compactification manifold B. Now, even more importantly in F theory, tau is, this elliptic fiber is allowed to become singular over points in B. And so to describe the places where tau becomes singular, it's very natural to introduce a Weier stress model for this Clavial fourfold. That just means that we're going to describe the elliptic fiber in terms of a cubic equation, y squared equals x cubed plus f times x plus g, where x and y are complex coordinates that, in which you consider this elliptic curve as a double cover of the x-plane. And f and g are going to be holomorphic sections of appropriate bundles over B. So of course, as f and g vary holomorphically over B, the cubic equation that defines this fiber, E sub tau, also varies, and therefore implicitly the complex structure of the fiber itself varies as you move around on B. Now the singularity is the fiber becomes singular precisely where the roots of this cubic equation coincide, and that's determined by the vanishing of the discriminant, delta, which is just 4f cubed plus 27 g squared. And so the vanishing locus, delta equals 0, defines a complex codimension 1 divisor inside B, and over this discriminant locus, the elliptic fiber becomes singular. Now, it turns out there's a very nice physical interpretation for this discriminant locus. Not only is there a nice physical interpretation for the complex structure tau, there's also a very nice physical interpretation for this discriminant locus. This complex surface, delta equals 0, is identified in F theory as being the location of various 7 brains which fill spacetime and wrap this complex surface inside B. So now in general, so the type of 7 brain that sits on this discriminant locus is determined by the type of singularity that you have in the elliptic fiber. And, well, it's sort of an essential result due to Kathayer that there's basically an ADE classification for the type of singularities that can occur in this elliptic fiber. And given that ADE singularity in the fiber, one finds on the world volume of the 7 brain the corresponding simply laced gauge group of ADE type. So in particular, in F theory, one can have 7 brains which carry not only the sort of classical groups as gauge symmetries, SUN or SO2N, say. But let me finish that statement. So I just to finish up, so I say in F theory, it's also possible to have exceptional 7 brains which carry gauge symmetries of exceptional type E6, E7, or E8. So those are the exceptional brains in my title. So I saw a number of questions.
The Weier stress model has only I1 singularities, if I
No, it's certainly possible. Well, I mean, it's certainly possible in a virus stress model to have Cadaver's classic. I mean, Cadaver's it's certainly possible more than high one singularities in a virus stress model, in a local virus stress model for local fibrillation.
I was going to ask a way more pedestrian version of the question, which is, so what kind of singularities does that description allow? So for instance, I can imagine one cycle of the torus shrinking down and being singular, and I guess I can imagine the other as well. Are those the only kind of singularities?
No, but the singularity you're thinking about is really the generic singularity. It's the I1 where you just have the one cycle in the torus shrink down, so you have the pinched torus. Uh-huh. Well, what can happen is you can have, essentially, you can have other, what can happen first is you can have, just imagine your torus pinching in more than one place. Okay. So then you'd have basically a sequence of P1s intersecting. And so those would essentially give you sort of the A series type singularities, and then there are other.
Okay.
Yeah, so. Now I'll give you sort of a much more explicit way to understand. I'll make this picture much more concrete for you, because I'm going to be able to see. All right. So what I'm saying is right. So in F theory, it's possible, depending on the singularity that occurs in this fiber, it's possible to have a seventh rank, which carries not only MSUN type gauge symmetries you would naturally find in type weakly coupled type 2B, but also say E6, E7, or E8. And that's of course what we want to exploit in terms of gut model building in F theory. So now this isn't, so in summary, I would say, so given this elliptically fibered flabby L4-fold, you specify the compactification manifold B as well as the behavior of the axial dilaton and the position of some space-time filling seven grains in F theory. But in general, this isn't really all the data you need in order to specify F theory compactified on X. Typically, if X is compact, there's a tadpole for the D3 brain charge. And to cancel the tadpole, you may also have to add some space-time filling D3 brains, which sit at points of B, as well as perhaps some combination of never Schwartz or Ramon freeform flux. So given the setup of the elliptically fibered cloud BL4-fold, some number of point-like D3 brains, and perhaps some bulk freeform flux is turned on in B, there's some very basic questions now you want to answer. First of all, what is the, from the perspective of the four-dimensional effective theory, what is the gauge symmetry in four dimensions? What is the spectrum of massless chiral superfields in four dimensions, either neutral or charged under the gauge group? And what is the effective superpotential that describes the interaction of those massless fields? So these are, of course, very basic questions one wants to answer. On the one hand, I find them, of course, I think they're intrinsically interesting questions to ask about the strongly coupled background of string theory. On the other hand, they're precisely the sorts of questions one has to answer just to get off the ground with any sort of model building in F theory. And basically the purpose of my talk is going to at least sketch for you schematically, in some particularly simple cases, the answer to those questions. So now, I'm only going to be studying the low energy description of F theory. So in fact, everything will be massless. Let's see. The massless function. I think all things I'll be discussing today will be massless.
What point on the fiber you are?
I'll be discussing the four-dimensional effective theory. So I mean, you know, once you go down to four dimensions, you maxify on X. There's no notion of being at the point of time or anything like that. So it's an important point, though, that I mean, I'm not trying to understand the microscopic details that they're in X. I just want to understand the very low energy degrees of freedom that live in four dimensions when I consider the spectrum. So this of course is a strongly coupled background string theory, so we don't have at our disposal the usual sort of weakly coupled string perturbation theory to answer these questions as we would say for the heterotic string. So we have to have, you know, we have to be a little bit clever as to how we're going to answer the question. There are basically two strategies one might try to take to answer, to figure out what this low energy effective description of F3NX is going to be. The first strategy would be to use the fact that, at least in certain situations, F3NX is dual to the heterodox string compactified on an elliptically fibered 5EL threefold. And the heterodox string, if, at least if it's weakly coupled, one, of course, knows precisely how to answer the questions that I ask. And then if one understands the duality well enough, one can translate back to F3. So this is more or less so this is actually discussed in the paper by Donaghy and Wehholt that I mentioned at the start. That's actually not the approach that we took in this paper to study F3NX. What we did was actually to simplify the question. So what we did was, rather than trying to study F3 on this arbitrary Calabi-Yau fourfold, we're going to simplify the problem by considering only local models for which B is the threefold B is non-compact, and just describes a neighborhood of this discriminant locus delta on which the seven branches wrap. So the idea is we're not going to try to describe all the degrees of freedom of F3. We're just going to try to understand the lower energy dynamics of the light degrees of freedom that live on the world volumes of these seven branches, possibly exceptional in F theory. The philosophy is very much that taken in when, you know, in the many, many studies of D-branes in type 2b, which sit at singularities in Calabi-Yau threefolds, where you just focus on the world volume curvature gauge theory. You just study the world volume curvature gauge theory that lives on the brain. So we're just trying to understand the analog of both curvature gauge theories for arbitrary seven branes in F theory. So now there are a couple of important simplifications that happen once we decide that we're going to restrict attention to local models for which B is non-compact. The first and perhaps the most essential simplification is that gravity decouples in eight dimensions. So the low energy description that we're going to find is just going to be an ordinary gauge theory. There's no gravity. The second thing is that because B is non-compact, we don't have to worry about this tadpole associated to the D3 brain charge. So that means we can consider very simple models for which there are no D3 brains and no bulk three-form fluxes present. And I'm saying we can just focus on the open string, the would-be open string degrees of freedom on the seventh branch. So now let me tell you, and coming back to the question that was asked about the sorts of singularities that are possible here, let me come back and give you some very concrete models for these local Calabi-Yau fourfolds that we're going to study. So now, even if we decide we're just going to study local models, the geometry of this discriminant locus inside X can still be quite complicated. So for instance, the discriminant could be reducible, consisting of several components which intersect, and over each component there's a particular type of elliptic singularity. So physically, this corresponds to some configuration of intersecting seven branes in X theory, each seven brain carrying a different world volume gauge symmetry. That's actually physically very, very interesting to consider, and actually the bulk of our paper is devoted to studying that case. But to start, I want to start by studying, you know, the philosophy is to start with the simplest thing possible. So I want to start by considering just the case for which this discriminant locus delta is isomorphic to S, an irreducible, smooth, compact Taylor surface. So there's only going to be, to start, one seven brain in the game. And maybe at the end of the talk, I'll say just a few words about what happens when we allow seven brains to intersect. So S is smooth, just for convenience. I want S to be compact because I want the gauge coupling in four dimensions to be finite. That coupling is inversely related to the volume of S. Now S is Taylor automatically because S is identified by construction. It's going to be the discriminant, which is embedded inside the threefold B. And if this elliptic vibration has a section, B is embedded inside the Calabi-Yau fourfold X. So S inherits a Taylor structure from X. And finally, of course, S is going to be a complex surface. So if you like, it's a real four manifold. Now, so I want to make a local model for X, which has this singularity, say, of arbitrary ADE type on S. To do so, I'm going to describe X. It's natural to describe X near S as a K3 vibration. So X will have the structure as follows, where the fiber is Y. Y is another complex surface, which, if we were interested in compact models for X, Y would itself be some compact elliptically fibered K3 surface. However, as I said, I'm only interested in local models. If Y has a singularity in the elliptic fiber of ADE type, and I zoom in on a neighborhood of that elliptic singularity in Y, then why just then this virus stress model for the singularity just reduces to one of the canonical ADE hypersurface singularities in C3. So I'm just going to take y. So to answer to your question, the elliptic singularities that you're talking about, if we looked at them closely, look just like the ADE hypersurface singularities here, where x, y, and z are just complex coordinates in C3. Now, in order to make this model for x, of course, in order for x to be a collimial fourfold, we have to appropriately fiber this ADE hypersurface y over s. And to describe the fibration, what I'm going to do is I'm going to allow the coordinates x, y, and z appearing here to actually transform as sections of appropriate tensor powers of the canonical bundle of s. So a, b, and c are integers, and I'm going to just assume that x is going to transform in the eighth power of the canonical bundle, y in the bth power, and c in the and z in the cth power. So in order to fix these, to finish making the model, we need to determine these integers a, b, and c. To fix them, we impose two conditions. The first condition is simply that you see these equations, once x, y, and z transform in these various powers of the canonical bundle, in order for these equations to make sense geometrically, each term in the equation has to transform in the same power of the canonical bundle. So the first condition is really just a condition of homogeneity of these equations. All terms in the equations have to have the same degree and power to the canonical bundle. So that imposes a number of linear relations on these integers a, b, and c, depending on the singularity. The second condition is really the Kolmogorov condition, which for this model just translates into the condition that if I look at the holomorphic 2 form on y, which is if I parameterize things dx, dz over y, then this holomorphic 2 form should transform as a section of the canonical bundle of the surface S. So this imposes another linear constraint that, for instance, a plus c minus b is equal to 1. So given these linear constraints that come from the homogeneity, and given this constraint that comes from the Kolmogorov condition, there's a unique solution for these integers a, b, and c. And with some malice aforethought, I've written these solutions for you right here. So let me make some comments about this construction. First comment is that, first of all, we weren't really guaranteed for the arbitrary surface S to be able to find, you know, at the outset, we weren't guaranteed that given the arbitrary surface S, we could make this, even this local model for X. For instance, what could have happened would be that A, B, and C were not integral. So, in fact, they are all integers except for this somewhat anomalous case of AN for N even. You see that these things would be half integral. And so at first glance, you know, that might worry you a little bit because it would mean that you'd have to be able to define a square root of the canonical bundle, which would mean that S would have to be spin. That's actually just an artifact of the coordinate parameterization I made for this ADE singular, for the A type A singularity. If I wrote the singularity as XY equals E to the N plus 1, this relaxes one of the homogeneity conditions. I can solve this, in fact, in arbitrary integers. So this is just a kind of a poor coordinate choice in that case. Now, there's another comment to make, which is that, well, by construction, you see, if you think about what this geometry looks like, these hypersurfaces are smooth, of course, away from the origin in C3. At the origin in C3, they have this singularity, and we identify S embedded inside X as precisely the origin. So this model describes this a fourfold with a homogeneous singularity of ADE type sitting on top of S. So this is precisely the background in F3 that we expect to describe a smooth, isolated 7-brain carrying a world volume gauge symmetry of type ADE. Finally, let me point out something. There's something kind of special that happens for the exceptional singularities. So you see, compared to the A or the B type singularities, the exceptional singularities appear automatically in this virus stress form. So in the exceptional case, we see that, for example, in this parameterization, x and y are identified with the affine coordinates on the elliptic fiber, and therefore z has to be a coordinate along the normal direction to s inside the threefold B. And in particular, you see that means that the threefold B is either the third, the fourth, or the sixth power of the canonical bundle of the total of S. And that means B is not Kolmogorov. Of course, the local Kolmogorov would look like the first power of the canonical bundle over S. So as we expect for the exceptional singularities, we're not doing Kolmogorov compactification. Now, for the A or the D singularities, you could also ask me, well, what is B in these models? And in this case, they don't appear in virus stress form. So you can ask, well, what is the total space? What does this threefold look like in this case? And I've arranged things such that in these cases, Z still describes the normal direction to the surface S inside B. So one can see that either by considering, by picking one of the sort of Kodaira models, one of the Weierstrass models for the singularity of type A N or D N, and then taking zooming in on the elliptic singularity, and you'll find that it reduces to these equations and you see directly. Or it can be a sort of more intuitive way to understand it, is just to observe that, say, in the AN case, this describes a seven-brain with gauge symmetry SUN, which you think might be related just to a D7 brain in a Calabi-Yau compactification of type 2B, since that's the standard gauge symmetry. And you'll observe in this case that regardless of N, Z always transforms a section of the total space of the canonical bundle over S. So in that case, if Z describes the normal direction to S inside B, B is always the local Calabi-Yau. Furthermore, in the DN type case, Z transforms into the square of the canonical bundle. So the square of the canonical bundle over this surface S can be really interpreted as a local orientifold geometry. So if you take the total space of the canonical bundle and mod out by the Z2 involution that acts non-trivially on the fiber and fixes S, that will give you the square of the total space. So this is really like gives you a local orientifold geometry as you expect for gauge symmetry type DN. All right, so now what we want to do is, now we want to ask the question that I sort of started with, what is the low energy description of F-theory compactified, well not compactified, but F-theory on this local model for X? So, well, you expect that sort of by construction in this case, all of the light degrees of freedom of F-theory are going to come from the world volume of the seven brain wrapping S. So what I want to do now is to discuss, in fact, the world volume gauge theory that lives on the seven brain. So the seven brain, I remind you, is wrapping, well, it's filling space-time and wrapping this arbitrary compact, smooth compact Kähler surface S. Now, in order to discuss this eight-dimensional gauge theory, on the seven brain, I want to begin by considering a very special, simple case, and that's just the case that S is not this arbitrary Kähler surface, but S is actually going to be C2. So in this case, we're really just considering F theory on this local K3 surface with an isolated ADE singularity compactified just to eight dimensional Minkowski space. Now, it's basically an axiom of F theory that if you do this, that F theory in this case is described at low energies just by the maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory in eight dimensions with the corresponding ADE gauge group, which will be script G. Now we want to do, what we want to do is to generalize this very special case, this non-compact sort of flat case, so the case of arbitrary S. And in this case, there's basically a standard adiabatic argument that says that all that happens is that locally the light degrees of freedom of F theory, if we cover S by these patches that look like C2, the light degrees of freedom in each patch look just like this eight-dimensional Yang-Mills theory. And globally, when you put the patches together, all that happens is that the degrees of freedom in the gauge theory are twisted. So this twist can be understood . It's not so hard to see this had to be the case. For one thing, so by construction, F theory on X is supposed to preserve N equals 1 supersymmetry in four dimensions. On the other hand, in general, if S is some arbitrary compact Kähler manifold, then S will admit no covariantly constant spinners, and if S isn't spin, S will not admit any spinners at all. So you know that the gauge theory on S has to be twisted. So if you expect N equals 1 supersymmetry, you have no choice but to twist the eight-dimensional gauge theory on S. Now, I'm not going to say much about this twist other than to observe the following. First of all, in higher dimensions, even in low dimensions, of course, there may be many distinct ways to twist supersymmetric gauge theory. But in high dimensions, because the R symmetry group typically becomes smaller, so of course in eight-dimensional, maximally supersymmetric eight-dimensional Yang-Mills theory, the R symmetry group is just U1. In that case, the possibilities for twisting are much more restricted. So first of all, just to twist this eight-dimensional Yang-Mills theory, it's necessary that S be a Kähler surface. So the Cato condition is essential. And furthermore, if we demand that the twist is going to preserve n equals 1 supersymmetry in four dimensions, the twist is actually unique. So just n equals 1 supersymmetry uniquely fixes the twist of the H-Mitchell-Yang null theory that we're going to consider. So let me now tell you just a little bit about this twist. First of all, I just want to tell you what the twisted degrees of freedom of this eight-dimensional Yang Mills theory on the seven brain are. So I'll tell you about the bosons and then the fermions. So first of all, we have the gauge field, which is just a connection, which from the perspective of S is going to be a connection on a G bundle, capital P over S. So I introduce P because a little bit later I'm going to want to consider instantons on S. So P might have some non-trivial topology. And now there are also, of course, there are two adjoint valued scalar fields that just came from the normal directions and reducing from 10 to 8 dimensions in Yang-Mills theory. So these adjoint scalars are twisted. So one of them, which I'll call phi, is going to transform as a section of the canonical bundle of S. And then it carries adjoint indices. But if you like, equivalent phi transforms on S is a two-form of holomorphic anti-holomorphic type 2-0. And then there's also the complex conjugate phi bar, which transforms in the conjugate bundle. And thus is a 0-2 form. Now, the fermions, it's kind of standard. The twisted fermions will transform as adjoint-valued differential forms on S. So you find, first of all, a fermion which I'll call eta bar alpha dot, which is just going to transform as a scalar on S with adjoint indices. So here this alpha dot index, so it's very important. So the fermions are twisted on S. From the perspective of S, they transform as differential forms. But from the perspective of Minkowski space, they transform as ordinary Weyl spinners. So the alpha dot is just the usual sort of right-moving Weyl spinner index in four dimensions. There's also a one form I'll call psi alpha. So psi alpha is actually a one form of type 0-1 from the perspective of S. And there's a two form which I'll call chi bar alpha dot. So he's actually a two form of type 0-2. And then since these fermions came from the eight dimensional the maximally supersymmetric H-Mitchell Yang Mills theory, they're also their CPT conjugates. So CPT acts as standard in four dimensions, and then from the perspective of S, it acts by complex conjugation of these bundles. So now I'll say a few words about the geometric interpretation of this twist in a little bit, but let me make one comment. First of all, the whole, as I mentioned, the sort of by construction, this twist is preserved n equals 1 supersymmetry in four dimensions. That's easy to see. So the twist acts on the supercharges of the H-Mitchell-Yang-Mills theory, just as it acts on these fermions. Now, the conserved supercharges are the ones which are transformed just to scalars on S, since those are, of course, the things which can be covariantly constant. So in this twist, you see that there are two scalars that come from eta bar alpha dot, which will just be the usual q bar alpha dot acting in four dimensions. And then the CPT conjugate, there's a CPT conjugate, eta alpha, which is also a scalar. And that gives the q alpha in four dimensions. So you see immediately that this twist does preserve n equals 1 supersymmetry, is going to preserve n equals 1 supersymmetry, as I claimed. Now, given these twisted degrees of freedom, the next thing to discuss in any topological gauge theory is what are the BPS equations that determine the supersymmetric field configurations of the theory. So let me say a few words about those. First of all, the BPS equations from the perspective of Minkowski space are completely trivial. They simply say that the gauge field has to be flat along R31. They say that these scalars, the 2-0 and the 0-2 form scalars, have to be covariantly constant on Minkowski space. And if you consider the mixed components of the curvature of A that have one leg on Minkowski space and one leg on S, then those mixed components also have to vanish. So all the interesting BPS equations have to do with the behavior of these fields on S. So I'll write those. So it turns out these BPS equations are precisely the equations. They're really a special case of the equations studied by Vafa and Witten in 1994 when they were considering a particular twist of the maximally supersymmetric n equals 4 Yang-Mills theory in four dimensions. So these BPS equations are pretty simple. They're F-term conditions, which I think will be no surprise. So the F-term condition says the 0-2 component of the curvature of the gauge field vanishes on S. So this connection defines a holomorphic structure on this bundle P. D bar of A is the covariant derivative defined by that connection along S. So this equation just says that phi is holomorphic, has to be holomorphic as a section of this. And then finally, so these are the F-term equations. The D-term equation is just given by omega wedge FA. So this plus I over 2 commutator phi bar equals 0. For omega is the Cator form on S. So now you want to know something about solutions to these equations. The simplest solutions are those for which phi is identically 0, in which case the equation simply says the curvature is anti-self-dual on S, and so we're just discussing an ordinary instanton on S. Now, in fact, in special cases, one can make stronger statements. So for instance, if S is a Del Pezzo surface, one can show that this bundle never has holomorphic sections. So on a Del Pezzo surface, the only way to solve these equations is to set phi is equal to 0, and the only solutions are instantons on the surface. So given the BPS equations, which determine supersymmetric field configurations on S, we simply want to pick. Now, of course, we're getting a little bit closer to trying to learn something about what guts are possible in F theory. We want to pick a supersymmetric field configuration, expand around that field configuration, and ask questions like, what is the massless spectrum? What is the superpotential? Exactly as we do in the heterodox string compactified on the Clausius threefold, only we're working on this complex surface S. So for instance, if we turn on an instanton in this bundle P on S, and then as you might guess, the fermion zero mode wave functions on S are just given by holomorphic sections of these bundles, and the massless chiral superfields in four dimensions are just determined by computing the double cohomology groups for the bundle associated to the instanton on S. So for instance, this fermion eta bar alpha dot, its zero modes come from H naught of the bundle. This guy, which is a 0-1 form, its zero modes come from H1. This 2 form, its zero modes come from H2. So the story is just like the heterodox string compactified on the Clausius threefold. For instance, one question you can ask is, in this case of the surface, is it possible to obtain a chiral spectrum in four dimensions? So let me give you a formula. So you see here that the chirality of the fermion in four dimensions, whether it's an alpha dot or an alpha, is correlated with the parity, whether or not it's a 0 form, a 1 form, or a 2 form. So as you probably would guess, the net chirality for any representation is just determined by an index computation. So for instance, if you want to ask what are the number of massless fermions in four dimensions transforming in some representation R minus the number transforming in some representation R bar, then if you just apply the index theorem, you'll find that this is given by computing the integral over S of the first Chern class of S, which with the first Chern class of some holomorphic vector bundle, which I'll just call V sub R, and that's determined by the instanton in the representation R. So this, of course, is an eminently computable quantity. It's not too hard to see that by choosing, if one has a lot of freedom to turn on instantons on S, it's easy to turn on something with a non-trivial first Chern class and find the chiral spectrum. Now, the next thing, so the final sort of thing you might want to ask about in the setup is, what is the superpotential that controls the interaction of these massless fields in four dimensions? For instance, is there a superpotential in the first place? Is it zero or non-zero? And if it's non-zero, how is it determined geometrically? So in order to discuss the superpotential, we have to say a little bit about the action for this eight-dimensional Yang-Mills theory. So let me write the action. There's only a very simple thing to say about that action. So the action really consists of terms of two forms. There's one term, which I'll write as the integral over R31 times S, integral d4x, where, of course, x is now a coordinate here on Minkowski space, times stuff that is q bar alpha dot trivial. So these things just contribute to D terms in four dimensions, and sort of the anti-chiral superpotential. And then there's one honest superpotential term in eight dimensions, which has the form integral over R31 times S, integral d4x d2 theta, something I'll write as trace of boldface FA 0-2, right, boldface phi. So here, boldface FA 0-2 and boldface phi are n equals 1 chiral superfields, which are constructed from the 0-2 component of the curvature FA, and whose lowest Bosonic component is the 0-2 component of the curvature. and whose lowest bosonic component is this 2-0 form phi. So this superponential you see, so this is a really an eight-dimensional version of the superponential, and you see that it's a quasi-topological object. There's no metric on S that appears on this object, and it's just determined by the holomorphic structure. So for instance, one can do the integral d through theta and expand the superponential out and components, and one will find a term of the form psi commutator phi psi plus dot dot dot. So it's this eight-dimensional Yukawa coupling when you reduce to four dimensions that precisely generates the effective four-dimensional superpotential. So the superpotential couplings are just determined by inserting into this term the zero mode wave functions for the fermion psi and the 2-0 form. So if you like mathematically, this superpotential gives you a trilinear pairing between two elements of H1 of this bundle, which we just described, moduli of the bundle, and an element of H0 of the canonical bundle, which is dual by surreality to some element of H2. So you have a pairing between two elements of H1 and the dual of H2. It's the natural thing. And so, for instance, and so we actually computed the superpotential in a large number of cases. In kind of a stupid way. So I said before that in the case that S is a Del Pezzo surface, one can show that this 2-0 form phi never has any zero modes. So when S is a Del Pezzo surface, if phi has no zero modes, then this Yukawa coupling, when you reduce to four dimensions, just vanishes trivially in all of those cases. So in that case, the superpotential vanishes identically. Now you can ask, so what I've said so far, if it's applied to a D7 brain wrapping a divisor in a Clavial threefold, I think it's completely standard. I mean, this is like just some like exercise. It's, I'm sure, not very surprising at all that there's some twisted topological eight-dimensional gate theory that lives on the D7 brain that describes you can use to say the physics of four dimensions. What's a little bit surprising is that if we really consider, say, one of these exceptional seven brains in F-theory, that all we have to do, even though this is some very strongly coupled background, there's this exceptional gate symmetry, that all we have to do if we want to study the effective theory is just to replace, say, SU in here, V8, and then the analysis goes through, so simply so. It's just a matter of group theory, really, to study the exceptional seven brain. So that might be a little bit surprising. I want to give you what I consider some very suggestive evidence that this sort of whole approach is actually correct. So I'm going to discuss, actually is a slight paradox related to the geometric interpretation of this twisted scalar 2 form phi naught that I think is quite illuminating. So you could ask, it's always a good idea to ask when studying the twisted gate theories, is why is phi transforming as a section of the canonical bundle and not some other bundle? So in the case of a D7 brain wrapping a divisor in a Clavial threefold, there's actually a very straightforward answer to that question. So let me remind you that in general, the adjunction formula provides an isomorphism between the canonical bundle of the surface S, if it's embedded as a divisor inside B, and the restriction of the canonical bundle of B itself to S, censored up with the normal bundle S inside B. So if B is a Calabi-Yau threefold, then of course the canonical bundle of B is trivial, and this adjunction formula just says that the canonical bundle of S is isomorphic to the normal bundle of S inside B. And this is precisely, so the fact that phi transforms as a section of the canonical bundle here, over there, is equivalent to saying that phi transforms as a section of the normal bundle, which is precisely what you'd expect for a D7 brain embedded inside B, since phi just describes the normal fluctuations, the normal motion of the brain. On the other hand, well, the paradox here is that in the case of, say, the exceptional brains, B is not a Calabi-Yau threefold. So this canonical bundle here restricted to S is non-trivial, and so the canonical bundle of S is not isomorphic to the normal bundle of S inside B. This, of course, jars a bit. So now this twist jars a little bit with your naive geometric intuition. So on the one hand, you think that maybe phi should always transform in the normal bundle to describe motion of the brain inside B. But on the other hand, the twist, you know, n equals 1 supersymmetry effectively just always fixes phi to transform as a section of the canonical bundle. So to resolve this paradox, we just need to think a little bit more carefully about how we actually describe the moduli associated to the position of seven brains in F-theory. So let me rewrite the global picture I had before. So X is an elliptic vibration over a complex base B with divisor discriminant locus delta equals zero. Now, of course, this delta equals zero is the thing that encodes the positions of the seven brains. On the other hand, if you think about it, the moduli which control the position of this discriminant locus inside B are just a subset of the complex structure moduli of the fourfold X. Since if you change the complex structure, you can move around the degenerate fibers and therefore move around the discriminant locus. So really, these positions of the seven brains in F theory are encoded by certain complex structure moduli of X. And in this local model for X that we're studying, those complex structure moduli of X are just going to be associated to deformations of this ADE hypersurface singularity Y. So to understand why I should transform in the canonical bundle, we just have to think about the deformations of the ADE hypersurface singularities. So let me sort of explain that with an example. I'm going to start with the case that I understand, which is just the case of the AN singularity. So of course, the AN singularity I wrote before, it's y squared equals x squared plus z to the n plus 1. Now, if I want to deform the singularity, I just add a bunch of lower order terms in z. I'll add a product from j is 1 to n plus 1, a factor z plus tj, where the tj are just going to be complex parameters that describe the deformation without loss. I assume that the sum t1 through up through tn plus 1 is equal to 0. So this assumption just allows me to eliminate the term that would be the z to the n. So when I expand this product, it takes the form where, so these things, S2, T up through Sn plus 1, T are just the elementary symmetric polynomials in all of these T's that I find when I expand this product. So this is, of course, very standard. Now, I'm jumping ahead of myself a little bit. Let me point out to you that the deformation theory, so this is the deformation theory of the AN singularity. The deformation theory of the D and the E singularities is precisely the same if we interpret these statements correctly. So the right way to interpret these statements is, first of all, the statement that the T's are complex parameters which sum to zero. We can equivalently consider that the T's are simply coordinates on the Cauchy subalgebra of SUN plus 1. Furthermore, of course, the elementary symmetric polynomials in the T's are the basic violin variant polynomials on this Cartan subalgebra. And so, in general, what happens if you consider the deformation theory of the arbitrary ADE singularity, the deformation parameters are always coordinates on the Cartan subalgebra of the corresponding simply Lie Lie group. And and when you consider the deformation of the singularity, the lower order term, the lower order terms that appear in the deformation of the singularity, the T's always enter those lower order terms through the basic violin variant polynomials on this Cartan subalgebra, which generate the full ring of invariant polynomials. So that's just some basic facts, but we want to interpret these. So first of all, it's very natural, certainly in this AN case, to identify these T's, coordinates on the Cartan subalgebra of SUN plus 1, with the eigenvalues of the scalar field phi. Of course, this is sort of clear for two reasons. First of all, turning on the T's resolve the singularity, so would decrease the gauge symmetry, just as you would expect that, of course, turning on some expectation value for phi would take the gauge Mitchell gauge group, so that's completely standard. And also, of course, you can see that turning on the T's actually moves the location of the singularities inside Y, so it's precisely what you would expect, you're moving the seven brain. On the other hand, you see, you know, there was this homogeneity condition when I constructed X that said that, for example, in the AN case, Z always transforms as a section of the canonical bundle. So for this deformation to make sense, the T's also have to transform as sections of the canonical bundle. Therefore, if I interpret the T's as the eigenvalues of phi, then I see immediately that phi has to transform as a section of the canonical bundle. So we can apply precisely the same reasoning to the case of the D or the E singularities. And in those cases, you also find that phi had to transform as a section of the canonical bundle. So let me actually do an example. I'm going to do the simplest exceptional example, which is just the case of the E6 singularity. So as I mentioned, in the case of the E6, the deformation parameters T will now be coordinates on the Cartan subalgebra of E6. And then somewhat schematically, the deformation of the general deformation of the E6 singularity looks as follows. So y squared equals x cubed plus z to the fourth, the singularity that I started with, plus lower order terms. All right, so these epsilons are just the viol invariant. These are the basic viol invariant polynomials on the Cartan-Sub algebra of E6. And the subscripts, they're homogeneous, and the subscripts indicate the degree. So, for instance, epsilon 2 is the basic comes from the basic quadratic Casimir of E6. And then E6 also has invariants of degrees 5, 6, 8, 9, and 12. Now, the interesting thing to observe is that, so for this E6, for the E6 singularity, x has degree 4. Y has degree 6, and Z has degree 3 in terms of powers of the canonical bundle. So this equation has total degree 12. On the other hand, you see there's this sort of highest degree invariant in E6, which has degree 12 in T. So just by homogeneity of this term, I see that T has to transform as a section of the canonical bundle. And of course, you can check that all the other terms are also consistent with that assignment. And therefore, if T transforms a section of the canonical bundle, and we identify it again with the eigenvalues of phi, we see that phi also, this identification of phi as a section of the canonical bundle here, which was just determined sort of indirectly by integral and supersymmetry, is consistent with this. And one can check that the numerology, there's a bit of numerology here, it works out quite nicely for all the other singularities. So this observation, this observation actually turns out to be quite powerful for two reasons. First of all, so you see what we've done here. So I started with giving you a description for just the basic ADE singularities in terms of this eight-dimensional twisted gauge theory. Now you can ask, but what I've given you here implicitly here is a description for a much broader class of Calabi-Yau 4 folds where I actually turn on an arbitrary deformation of this singularity. I know now how to interpret this deformation, so if I gave you just some arbitrary holomorphic coefficients here, I could those coefficients implicitly determine these eigenvalues of phi. And then I know that F theory in that background is just described by this eight-dimensional Yang-Mills theory, for which I've turned on a holomorphic expectation value for the two-form phi. So on the one hand, this provides a way to describe a much larger sort of reading this result backwards. One can describe F theory in a much broader class of local models. And one interesting thing about these sort of models is you already see here, so I mentioned that sort of the interesting thing in F theory is really to discuss the case of intersecting seven brains. So already a model of this form has it within it intersecting seven brains. T of T, of course, the expectation of these eigenvalues T, they're generally transforming the sections of the canonical bundle. So if they're holomorphic, they're typically vanishing over, if the canonical bundle is non-trivial, they vanish over some complex curves inside S. So where these eigenvalues vanish, you interpret those things physically as being the intersections, the loci of intersections of, say, two seven brains in F theory. But if you want to understand what happens when seven brains of arbitrary type intersect in this n equals one backgrounds of F theory, it's enough to study this eight-dimensional twisted Yang-Mills theory in the background of a non-trivial holomorphic expectation value of T. So maybe I'll just say, since I'm just about kind of the end of my time, I'll just say a few words about what happens in F theory when you have intersecting seven brains. So there are basically two ways in which one might try to determine you might ask, are there low energy degrees of freedom living on the intersection of two seven brains in F theory? And how do you describe those? So one way is, as I said, is to consider this eight-dimensional Yang-Mills theory in the background of a non-trivial VEV for phi. So what happens in that case is that, so generically phi, the VEV for phi is non-zero. So the gauge group would be Higgs. But over the place where phi vanishes, this curve is possible. The curve over which phi vanishes where the seven brains intersect, one actually finds zero modes. One actually finds some bosonic and fermionic zero modes trapped along the intersection of the trapped along the curve where phi vanishes, and those give rise to light degrees of freedom, which live on the intersection of the seven brains in F theory. Maybe another somewhat more direct way is just to consider, in precise analogy to the way we study this eight-dimensional Yang-Mills theory, just consider the sort of the trivial case of two D7 brains intersecting transversely along a six-dimensional Minkowski space. And in that case, you know you find that setup preserves eight supercharges, and along the six-dimensional intersection, one finds bifundamental hypermultiplet matter. All that happens, so once again, one can argue indirectly, so one can take that sort of local model, and the global model is just determined by twisting that n equals 1 by the global model is determined just by twisting the bifundamental hypermultiplet matter. So along the so the general statement is that when you have intersecting seven brains in F theory, along the intersection one finds a defect theory, a six-dimensional defect theory, in which some twisted bifundamental hypermultiplet matter lives that couples to both of the gauge theories, that would couple to both gauge theories that live on the two seven brains. So there's sort of one can analyze that twisted bifundamental hypermultiplet matter in completely the same way that we've discussed this eight-dimensional gauge theory here. It turns out one can do things like compute the, you know, compute, of course, what is the massless chiral spectrum? What are the interactions for the superfinitial terms? Turns out there's also a nice story involving matching the moduli associated to this. There's a nice story, of course, if you turn on a VEV, you expect if you turn on a VEV for this bifundamental matter living on the intersection of the seven brains, that should correspond to brain recombination in the geometry. And there's kind of a nice match between the topological gauge theory that describes this twisted hypermultiplet matter and the way in which the brain recombination is realized in geometries of this form. So I don't want to run over, but thank you very much. So I'll end here, but thank you very much for your attention.
So how much is known in general about this X? Does it have to be always elliptically fibrous, or it can be torus fibrous?
Well, I think it should, you know, I think actually it should be elliptically fibrous, because if it were only torus fibrous, what would you tell me the tau should be? I mean.
So I'm asking because if X is elliptically fibrous, it's given, I think, always by a wire stress model.
If it has a section, so and I don't think that's another technical condition that I mean, if it doesn't have a section, it's like there's some H, but there's some, or their flux is turned on, like there's no flux.
Right. So, but when it's a wire stress model, then I think it's what we discussed that the discriminant divisor is always reducible.
Yeah, I thought about that. If you require the discriminant to be other than a phi one type, I think that's certainly an example.
So I'm thinking how to avoid it. So how to have S irreducible, like what you discussed, and embed it into a comfort space. So I don't know if there are obvious ways.
Yeah, I was playing with some examples last time, and indeed it was difficult to make global examples.
Right. So I think it has to be something which is not a wire stress model. So that's.
Maybe we should
discuss this. I have a pedestrian question. Sure. What prevents the massless particles from getting de-instant tone corrections?
Well, there can be, that's a good question. So the most obvious sort of instantons to consider in this geometry would be D3 brains, which wrap divisors inside B, instead of points inside R31. And so these typically look like gauge theory. These look like gauge theory instantons in the effective particle gauge theory that I've been talking about. So there certainly you expect to have corrections.
Wait, which massless particles? You mean charged? Are they charged or not?
No, it's generic. Generally, I don't care whether they're charged or not.
No, if they're charged, how can you have a superpotential for them? I mean, you will need to have some anomalous U1 whose axion actually can cancel the charge.
But if they're not charged, would they get it?
If they're not charged, then nothing prevents it.
But then when the...
Then they're just moduli. I mean, they can, of course, they can have it.
In the strong coupling limit, these would be very heavy. Is that right? Because the mass corrections would go like 1 over G string. Isn't that right? I mean, if they are instant on corrections, the mass correction should go like 1 over G string.
Well, I think what one typically expects is that if the instanton generates some potential for the module, I mean, you just roll off some other points.
In the beta bin.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. The super potential will behave as e to the minus 1, which is string times something, times some.
Yeah, but you can. Yeah, and. Yes.
So if g string goes to 0, 1 over g string goes to infinity, e to the minus
infinity
is 0.
No, so in this strong coupling image, e to the power.
Then they.
I mean, your question is a little bit ill-defined because the if the instanton generates a potential for the moduli, you're not what you'll find is that from the perspective of Ford mentioned, you're not expanding around the anonymous vacuum of the theory. So I don't think you should really talk about the mass of the particle. Maybe you should you want to go to the vacuum, wherever that vacuum happens to be, and then talk about the mass there.
Okay.
But it's a good question. So we haven't, the simplest answer would be that, if you have the D3 grain struck and the divisors in the threefold are captured by DH3 instantons. DH3 instantons in the effective four-dimensional, in the first DH3. So.
Any more questions? If not, let's thank Chris again.